You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Hey, everybody. Just one quick question before we get to this week's podcast. Are you enjoying these podcasts? If so, do me a favor. Go on to iTunes right now and give us a big, fat, juicy 5-star rating or however many stars they have. I'm not even sure. Or write us a great review. It's the best way to promote theater to the rest of the web. Thanks so much for listening.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Ken Davenport here. You're listening to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I am so excited for today's guest because he's one of my favorite composers and part of one of the greatest musical theater writing teams we have today. Ladies and listeners, welcome to the podcast, Tony Award-winning composer Stephen Flaherty. Welcome, Stephen.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So I first came to know Stephen's work when I wandered into the Booth Theater back in 1991. I was a sophomore at NYU. I didn't know what I was in for. It turned out I was into one of the most joyous nights I've ever had in the theater. It was seeing Once on This Island, and it remains that to this day, one of my favorites. In addition to Once on This Island, some of Stephen and his collaborator Lynn Ahrens' early work includes Lucky Stiff, My Favorite Year, which, side note, Larger Than Life was one of my audition songs when I was an actor. And then, of course, Seussical, the monumental ragtime, which I was lucky enough to be the associate company manager on, Rocky, and what I call their Lincoln Center shows, A Man of No Importance, Desiree's, Glorious Ones, and so on. And upcoming, about to open in a few months, Out of Town, Anastasia, based on the movie which featured his songs, including the Oscar-nominated Journey to the Past, and on and on and on. I could go on for days with just
your
bio. That
is good research. Very good, Ken.
But enough bio stuff. Let's get to the juicy questions and answers. Yeah. Tell us, when did you know you wanted to write for the theater?
Well, you know, it's funny. I never thought of it as writing. I thought of it as making stuff up. And I think I've been making stuff up ever since I was a kid. I started playing piano at age 7. I started making stuff up whenever I was 12, and I wrote my first musical whenever I was 14, and we did it at my high school, and it was hilarious.
What was it called?
It was called Pits, because I grew up in Pittsburgh, and each scene took place in a different locale, different neighborhood of my hometown, and each number was written in a completely different musical vocabulary, and each number was written in a different color ink. So, of course, the big gospel spectacular was, you know, the final scene, and we had a country western song, a rock and roll song, and it was the most fun I've ever had in my life. And oddly, there was a subplot that involved Siamese twins, and this was way before Sideshow. So,
will we see a revival of Pits?
No, you will not. You will not. But it was the kind of thing that it was two friends of mine who were in the drama department who had gotten what they said were roles that weren't large enough for their talents that year. They decided to write their own show, and they said, "Do you want to write music?" And I had never really thought of writing music, you know, but clearly I was a theater kid. And we were a bit of a hit, you know, at my little school. And I had a wonderful music teacher and a wonderful drama teacher. And they both said, you should do more of that. And so I did. And this is all I've ever wanted to do. Like, since I was a kid, and I just was obsessed with theater, and I had to be part of it. And also, you know, because you're a producer of the recent revival of Godspell, that is the first professional show that I ever saw. It came through my town. We were taken to it because, you know, it starred Jesus. And so the nuns from my parochial school took us to see the Jesus musical, Godspell. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I just thought, I have to somehow be a part of that.
So you said, clearly I was a theater kid. And I hear this a lot from people that do the podcast.
We're nerds, let's face it, yeah.
So what is it that so clearly said you were a theater kid? What about the theater? Like, you're obviously an incredibly talented composer. And even back then, obviously, you had a flair for music. Why the theater not say, I want to write like the Beatles? I want to write...
I honestly think because theater and music theater in particular combines so many art forms, and it's this American mongrel art form. And at the time as a kid, I was drawing, I was painting, I was trying to write stories, I was learning music, I was trying to write music, I was putting on odd little shows in my basement. And I think all of that stuff, I thought I can use all of this in creating musical theater. And also for me personally, I was not kind of like a team sport kind of kid. You know, I was a personal best kind of a kid. I was really good at figure skating. But in terms of the team, I liked being part of a community. I liked being part of a team. I loved creating something with my friends, and I loved creating something as part of a community. I started and I never stopped. And like, I'm lucky it worked out because I can't do anything else. This is all I can do, you know? So
you're a career in figure skating or career in
musical
theater.
That's right.
You leave high school. You're the hit of the high school. What happened after high school?
Well, it's an interesting thing. It dawned on me slowly that the musical star of each high school then goes to college. And then if you're lucky, you become the musical star of the college. And then you come to New York, and it's a series of being thrown to the bottom of the barrel. And it's very humbling. And I was pretty much self-taught, and I needed to get some technique. And so I went to CCM, Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music. And at that time, the 80s, they didn't have a program for writers of music theater. So I basically went there and studied classical composition, orchestration, conducting, took some theater classes, and basically started making my little shows there. And I had no collaborator because, you know, this is Ohio, you know, there's nobody to play with. So I became a book writer and a lyricist and a music director and a composer. And it was a wonderful time at that school because there were so many talented people there. I was a freshman and Faith Prince was a senior and Jason Graw was there. And it was an amazing group of repertory players. And we would do student-based shows. And then whenever I came to New York, I had my little group of repertory players from Cincinnati. And so they became the cast of Lynn's and my first musical, which was Bedazzled, which was based on the Peter Cook Dudley Moore. And she said, "Where are you finding these amazing people?" And I said, "They're my classmates." And it was a good thing that we all moved as a group to the city.
Any chance of us seeing a revival of Bedazzled?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. Lynn and I guess it was 2 years ago, we did a series of concerts at 54 Below because it had dawned on us slowly that we had been collaborating for 30 years, which is kind of impossible for me to believe, but that's true. And we thought it would be really fun just to celebrate it because it was such a big round number. And so we thought we'll do it at 54 Below. And we wanted it to be equidistant between my birthday and her birthday. And we thought it would make it like a celebration month and invite people that we've worked with, people that we wanted to work with. And we wanted to do some early songs. So we had actually two Bedazzled songs that we did as part of the evening. And then we did two songs that we had written that year. And we thought it would be kind of really cool to have songs that were written, you know, in the first year of our writing and songs to that point, the last. And God, what a fun time that was. And I should point out, it's a live CD. You can get this. It's called Aarons and Flaherty, Nice Fighting You, which is a lyric from Lucky Stiff.
We'll put a link to that when we put up this podcast. So let's talk about Lynn. Obviously, Lynn did a podcast with me a few weeks ago.
She loved it, too.
Oh, good. Did you listen?
I haven't heard it. No.
Oh, good.
Oh.
So I feel like I'm about to do one of those like dating shows where I've talked to one partner on this side, and now I'm going to ask you.
Well, you know, our answers are going to be totally different. We thought if we would ever write a book, it would have to be like a he said, she said. And you could read Lynn's from, you know, from this cover, and then you'd flip the cover over, and then my version. And my guess is it would be like an amazing Rashomon story. Like somewhere between these two tellings is what went down.
You're going to get an interest from a publisher after they hear this for sure, because that book sounds fun. So you meet her at the BMI workshop, right?
Yeah.
And what did you think when you met her? Were you like, oh, this is the one? This is.
I shouldn't say this, but I found this to be true in a lot of workshops and a lot of music theater programs. There's always a lot of terrific or, you know, good composers. And there's always one good lyricist in any class that's usually been my experience. And she was so fresh in her approach to what she did. It was really different from what I would do. And my idea of what writing was about, I had a beard that year. You know, I was like, I would wear black. I had a beard. I would like lock myself in a monastic kind of room and somehow summon the muse, and I would write music. And she came from a totally different background. She came from like the commercial and pop music world, and she would write on her feet. She would literally throw ideas around, and it was much more of an improvisatory kind of background, which was totally different, you know, where I would score it all to paper. And at that time, well, you know, I had never really collaborated, you know, and I have to backpedal to the first week I was here. I got to go and meet Stephen Sondheim, believe it or not. Yeah, at his home. And I had a little cassette, because that's what we had back then. We had things that were called cassettes. And I gave him a couple of my tunes. And the short of it, or at least what I got from the critique, was that he felt that I had a gift for music and musical counterpoint. And he didn't like my lyrics. You know, he didn't care for them. So I thought, okay, maybe I should try, you know, this working with another lyricist. It could be shake things up. It could, you know, lead to a new or an exciting thing. And so in BMI, you do these class assignments, and there's one a week. And it was literally the last class assignment, and I had not collaborated yet. And Lynn was walking down the street, and I was maybe almost a block away, and I projected very far. And I said, Lynn, do you want to write a song together? Let's do this last song together. And she goes, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. And we had never... It was an interesting first meeting, because like she denies this, but she said, all right, so let's hear something, make something up. And I was not used to creating in front of another person. You know, it was like, ooh, I don't, you know, I felt kind of naked, honestly. And, it was such a different way to find a song, to find a piece of music. And I realized, oh, I get it. Like we both have a hand on the driving wheel, and we're trying to find a way that we can connect to find the song. And I must say our first song was not good, but the process of creating it was great. And after that, we said, oh, we should try to find a project. And that's when we began writing Bedazzled. And we just had so much fun, and it was a totally different way of working for me. And I think the whole thing about collaboration is, you know, why even collaborate? And it's because you can find something that you wouldn't have been able to create on your own. That's what I think, you know. And so we just started, and we didn't stop. And that was my first year in New York.
I love that statement, because it's a very selfless statement coming from an artist, especially someone who's been doing it all before that.
Yeah. You know, it's a tricky thing, because to face a blank piece of paper or a blank screen each day, you know, you have to have either balls of brass or a huge ego or an incredible, immense faith, you know, that somehow an idea will come and manifest itself, or all three. You know, and I really think that writing is an enormous leap of faith. And after all of these years, I can't honestly tell you how it works, because there is an element of mystery that I think is wonderful. And I don't want to overanalyze or analyze that at all, because it is alchemy, and it is mysterious. and ideas fly in the side door at weird times and odd places. And I think it's really exciting. And I think working, you know, Lynn and I have worked with young writers a lot recently, actually for like a decade and a half now. And you can teach them technique and you can teach them how to analyze the work of others. You can't teach them how to have an idea or where ideas come from. And I honestly don't know where they come from. And that's been part of the fun. And like, and no day is the same as the day that precedes it either. So each one of our writing days is you're starting from scratch. And I love that.
So you said it's part of the fun, but there have got to be those days when you stare at the blank page and nothing comes out. How do you deal with the famous writer's block if it ever pops up?
You know what? I've never really had writer's block. I shouldn't say that because now that I have said that, you know.
God, please don't let me like object, Stephen Flaherty, no,
it's like you're tempting fate, but I always believe that it is a leap of faith and that there's more where that came from. And as a young writer, I used to freeze up sometimes because I would get to, say, measure 16. And you know, at measure 16, there's a fork in the road. And if you go make choice A, the piece becomes that. And or choice B, it becomes a different kind of thing. And rather than just making a choice or blindly going forward, I would not know which choice was the right choice, as if there were anything, you know, that was right or wrong. And Lynn's she loves to rewrite. And I think the craft of writing reveals the song. So we might try many different approaches until we find the approach that actually works for any given song moment. So I think believing that there are many different ways to get to where you need to go, I think that that's a valuable thing to know.
Is your process for writing with Lynn the same as it was back then? How do you approach something now versus how you approach something?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because we had starts, actually false starts at a couple early shows. Like we wrote a song score for Bedazzled that became sort of spoken about a lot around town. Everyone wanted to hear that show. We had producers that wanted to produce that show. We could never get the rights to that show. So that never happened. And then we worked on our follow-up was an original idea that we were actually writing with George C. Wolfe. And this is like George C. Wolfe pre the Colored Museum, pre the Public Theater. And that was like an interesting notion in search of a plot that we never found. And so all of these things, and you know, Lynn is like, she comes from the commercial world, which moves much faster than my, you know, my monastic upbringing of music. So then we began working on a third show, and we hadn't been produced at that point. And I actually think that was an asset, because I think it allowed us the time to get to know one another, to get to know one another's processes, which at the beginning were very different. And, you know, we got to date longer before we, you know, were at that altar. And I think that was a great idea, you know, and we got to know one another. And I think it deepened our relationship and it deepened our writing craft. And I think if I had just come into New York, met Lynn in the first month, and I did, within 6 months, I'm writing with her. And the very first thing I try to write got produced, which all of these things are happening. I think it would have given me like an incredibly distorted view of how things happen, you know. And I think having something not get produced, it makes it gives you a little more resilience, you know. And so it was maybe 5 years until we had our first show produced, which was Lucky Stiff.
It's so funny you say that about Pasek and Paul were on just a couple of weeks ago.
They're great.
They are fantastic.
Aren't
they amazing? But they talked about getting a show up. It happened very quickly for them and how they felt like they made some mistakes early on. And it was very difficult to get through that and on to their next show because it happened
right.
So fast.
Well, you know, Lynn and I co-founded a program at the Dramatists Guild, which is an amazing program. It's called the Dramatists Guild Fellows. And it's one of the few programs here in New York City for composers, librettists, lyricists, and playwrights. Because usually in a lot of the writing programs in New York, they tend to ghettoize the word people, the playwrights, and then the music people are in like their own little clubhouse, and never the twain meet. And this program, it's astounding. It's very intimate. There's mentorship. There's opportunities to basically ghost writers and ghost performers as guests. It's all about the process. And Pasek and Paul were our youngest Dramatists Guild fellows. They were right out of college, and they were like so amazingly talented. And it was great to see them as kids. And now I was just talking about their new show at Second Stage. I can't wait to see it. I'm going to try to see it next week.
And talking about Dear Evan Hansen, but we're getting back to you now. You're such a generous artist. You're talking about other people and how great they are. What I love about your scores is the diversity of them, from the Caribbean rhythms of Once on This Island to ragtime. And you actually just talked about Pitts, how Pitts had different gospel country.
Yeah.
How do you access those different styles? Do you do research before? What's the process of getting into the score itself?
I'm just really open to all kinds of music. And my playlist is crazy all over the map. And even as a young kid growing up, I wasn't really a rock and roller, but I was an R&B kid. And we had one of the great R&B stations in Pittsburgh called WAMO. And my father couldn't stand that kind of music. So he would give me the keys to the car, and I'd be like seven. And I'd be like a seven-year-old starting up the engine and listening to the radio in that car. And it was amazing. So I really responded to rhythm and responded to those kinds of rhythms. And then a little later, I began studying classically. So I had a classical piano background. I spent a summer working in Nashville, Tennessee. So I picked up a lot of stuff down there. I began studying, you know, music theater scores. And I think, honestly, I never like to repeat myself. And I know that Lynn and I, in looking at material, we try to find something that we've not done before. You know, and I think that keeps it fresh. The process of writing the shows is always different, and it always is dictated by the subject matter and the musical materials. Once on This Island was a show that didn't want to be written at the piano, you know, where Ragtime was a show that had to be written at the piano, you know, for a lot of that music. And I'm just fascinated by it. I actually did a somewhat experimental, really cool piece this past summer at the Old Globe in San Diego called In Your Arms. And it was Christopher Gattelli, the wonderful choreographer, director, who came up with the notion of, let's do a theme and variation show all about dance. And it was his really cool idea to come up with one topic, which is romantic destiny. And then he went to 10 different playwrights and said, you can write on this theme. It can be any gender, any culture, any time period, any story, any style, comedy, tragedy. The only thing is you can't use words. So they were writing basically scenarios that then would be all danced. And so we had 10 of them, and the stories were so wildly different. And then I would have to find some way to translate each playwright's individual story and their point of view and their approach into music. And so each of them it was really like writing a complete musical. And it took us 7 years to get the show together, because we would only do maybe two at a time, three at a time, because they were all over the map. Like Douglas Carter Bean wrote a piece, New York City in the Roaring Twenties, at a drag ball at Webster Hall. And I thought, okay, know how to do that. And there would be a piece by Alfred Urey, and it was about young love in 1950 in Atlanta, Georgia, in a Cadillac, and up on Lover's Lane. I thought, oh, I know how to do that. And then David Henry Hwang early on threw me a huge curveball. It was a piece set in modern day Shanghai in a techno club. And then the lead actor, somebody puts a drug in his drink. He's transported back in time to the Ming Dynasty. He had written it for a friend of his who was a star of the Peking Opera. And he said, it's really important to have martial arts in this piece. And I just thought that is the wildest thing I've ever heard. And I was so scared for the longest time about that particular piece. and then finding a new way to approach it, it actually became great, great fun. And it became a favorite, you know. And the thing that scared me most was the thing that probably gave me the most joy in the long run.
Do you think any subject can be made a musical? Do you think any story, or does a musical require a certain something? And if so, what's that something that you look for?
Well, I always feel that it needs to have some sort of heightened quality, you know, whether it's in the language or... I think the hardest thing to translate into musical terms is something that's very kitchen sink. And for me personally, after writing Ragtime, which was a wonderful experience for all of us, and we loved working with Terrence McNally, and he said, you know, we should absolutely do another show. But we figured Ragtime is so, that you couldn't do a show larger than Ragtime. So we thought, why don't we do the exact opposite thing? We'll do a miniature show. And he said, is there a kind of music that you're interested in? And, you know, as you know, the Irish people in Ragtime are the villains. And so we were just cutting all of their music, you know, those evil Irish people. And of course, I'm Irish American. My parents were not happy that the language of and the poetry and the music of my people had been cut, you know, from this quintessentially American show. So I thought, you know, I would like to try my hand at doing something Irish. And I said to Terrence, I said, we should look at different things. And I said, I'm not interested in doing the potato famine musical. I said, but I would like to do something that has an Irish color, Irish flair. And Terrence found a small independent film called A Man of No Importance that starred Albert Finney, Brenda Fricker, Rufus Sewell. And it was all about the creation of theater, and it was all about the love of friendship, and it was a man's coming out story. And it was very naturalistic. And I couldn't for the life of me get music out of that because it was so naturalistic. And I said, I can't find the heightened quality. I don't know how to get them singing. And also the lead character who in our show is played by Roger Rees was so secretive, and he didn't really have a scene partner to talk about what he was feeling, you know, in his heart. So it was virtually impossible getting this guy to sing. And then Terrence gave us a great gift. He made a surround for the show. So the entire show took place in one instant in the main character's mind. And it was him remembering what had happened in the past couple of weeks to bring him to what was a low point for him. And also the character of Oscar Wilde is mentioned in the film. He's not in the film. And Terrence put him right in the show. So all of a sudden there was a fantasy character, Oscar Wilde, and he was Alfie Byrne, our hero, his scene partner. And the minute Oscar Wilde was allowed to be in the room with him, the music just poured out. And it was the most amazing thing. I couldn't understand. I couldn't get this character to sing at all before. And now I couldn't get him to shut up, you know, because he had Oscar Wilde there. And Terrence is a funny guy because, you know, because he'll write a scene which will inspire a song. And usually whenever we're presenting the song, you know, it's a lot of information to analyze. So he tends to be very analytical. And every single song I've ever played for him, he's never said, wow, can I hear that again? Never once. This is the entire score of Ragtime. Never once. And I've written with Lynn a song called Man in the Mirror, which was our character of Alfie Byrne singing to his reflection. But in fact, he's singing to Oscar Wilde, and he drops a huge plot bomb at the end of the song. And Terrence just lit up. He goes, oh my God, that's our show. That's the sound of our show. Will you please play it again? The only time, you know, and
Terrence, wheels of a dream, yeah, daddy. No,
not at all. And he blushes whenever I bring this up, but I think he was so taken because it had been such a struggle to find the musical core or the sound or a way to get music to come out. And that was cracking the nut. And then the show wrote itself quite quickly after that.
And for those of you out here who don't know it, go get that recording. It's a terrific score and one of my favorite Streets of Dublin. Having Stephen Pasquale sing that, I will never forget that moment. So I'm going to ask you one of my James Lipton questions, speaking of some of your most memorable songs. I want you to imagine that the Smithsonian calls you.
Okay.
And says, Stephen, we have room for one of your songs.
Oh, wow.
In the Institute. Just one. Which one of all the songs that you've written would you want preserved?
You know, that's a hard question because I always think of songwriting and creating theater as like parenting, and hopefully it's good parenting. And it's like you never want to pick a favorite, you know, like you never want to pick son number two over son number three or, you know, whatever. I would think it would have to be something from Ragtime, though, because that show came to us as a gift. And some of your listeners may know, some might not, but, you know, that was a show that we had to audition to get. And it was a majorly crazy story to get the show. And I was so happy that that was part of it, because I remember reading in the New York Times that the theatrical rights for the novel Ragtime had been acquired. And I'm like, shit, like Kander and Ab are going to like, oh, with that show, all those lucky guys. And whenever they just opened it up to basically a songwriting derby, I think there were maybe 12 teams. And we got a beautifully written treatment by Terrence McNally that was 65 pages. And you could write, the assignment was you had to write four songs based on Terrence's treatment. And we knew in order to get this job, which I was obsessed with, I was so passionate about it. Because I had been a Ragtime piano player since I was 12. Remember The Sting? Remember that? Yeah. And like all the little kids were like playing the entertainer and I loved it. I just thought to try to take that kind of music and yet make it sound fresh again and reinvent it. And it was about America and about, all of these different ingredients in one, you know, in one stew. I just thought I really want to do this. And we had 11 days to write, arrange, produce, record, mix, stick it on a cassette, back in the day of a cassette, and hand it in. And the day we had to hand it in was the opening night of Showboat. I mean, it was all this crazy theatrical Garth Drabinsky timeline. And we started counting the days that we had to do all of that. We had 11 working days. So being practical, you know, we just decided, you know, I will write two songs, music first, and Lynn would write two songs, lyric first. We would swap. And three of the four songs are in the show. And so I think for me personally, I think I would probably pick the title song, which is also opens the show. And it's Ragtime. And I would pick it because I remember the process of writing that song. And it was... there was such velocity, with such passion. It wound up being 10 minutes long. It was like incredibly long, this song. And also just trying to see, with only so many musical ingredients, how you could tell that much story, that much about the theme, that much about the musical character of the evening, and somehow make it a cohesive, exciting opening. And that was a music first one, you know. So... I just remember that as being an exciting, thrilling time, you know, writing that.
What were the other two songs everyone's dying to know?
Oh, the other two? Well, it's a song that we close Act One with called Till We Reach That Day. And that was an interesting one because that also was music first. And it was going to be the funeral of Audra McDonald's character, Sarah. And so I wrote like a gospel tinged song that would be sung by the ensemble. And Lynn said, well, you know, it sounds so hopeful. And I said, they're feeling rage, but yeah, this is something that would be sung, you know, something like in this flavor. And she said, well, I think that the subtext of rage has to start bubbling forward. So I go, great idea. So I wrote this really angry ragtime figure that was what Kohlhaas was thinking, and then eventually other people, and eventually it became a song like, we can't allow this to happen anymore in this country. And having those two kinds of music at odds with one another, it was really what made the song. And I listened to this demo to this day, and I'm like, why is that demo better than what we had on either recording, and I had forgotten we had a secret ingredient, and here it is. On the alto line, singing, like right at the edge of it, was Billy Porter. So he was singing the women's parts, and I'm like, that was the secret ingredient. That's why it never had that, because Billy Porter was never singing that line ever again in any version of the show. But that demo was hot. Then the other song is a song called Gliding, which is Tata and his daughter, the immigrant character.
I tell a lot of people that one of my greatest memories in the theater was I was the associate company manager on that show, and our office was in the basement of the Ford Center.
I remember it well.
And whereas some people would take a coffee break or a smoke break, I would take a break and just watch the show because it was such a magical production.
It was an incredible time for all of us. I think all of us that were able to get near that show, it changed our lives, I think, really for the better.
What did you think when Garth went bankrupt, went to jail, all this nonsense?
Well, you know, every single day that I worked with Garth was an exciting day. And if you would say, what is his talent? I would say his talent was making other people excited. First of all, he had an amazing taste. Secondly, I always felt I was so protected, you know, by him, that he would not let the show off the tracks. You know, it was a very extravagant time, and we couldn't fully understand how we were able to get these enormous orchestras. And he commissioned a suite of music from the piece, which was really cool because I was able to just look at the music for music's sake without, you know, having to serve story or the book. And I created a big symphonic piece with William David Brone, our inspired orchestrator. And we recorded it with an orchestra of like 65. And it's like, how's that happening? And none of it quite made sense, but we were just loving every moment while it lasted. So, you know, he's a complicated guy.
Is that what you like to get out of producers? When you've worked with a lot of them, from Garth to Barry Weissler, very different styles and types.
And Andre Bishop. We've done many, many shows with Andre, both at Playwrights Horizons and Lincoln Center.
So what do you look for from that relationship? Like, what would make you want to work with a producer today?
I always think I bring it back to good parenting. I think each show is individual. It has its own personality. I think you need to deliver exactly the uniqueness of that show. And I don't think it's possible nor advisable to make a musical or any piece of theater all shows to all people. Because once you start doing that, its individuality flies out the window. I mean, Once on This Island is so special because it followed no rules. It was very much its own kind of show, kind of score, kind of storytelling. And the creation of the show is absolutely pure. We never designed that show to be, this will be a Broadway show. We were just creating something with people that we loved. And it was about creating magic out of nothing. And that's what the show was. And the fastest writing I've ever done, we wrote the whole show in 6 months. You know, and then changed one song on its way to production. And I think that was good producing. That was Andre Bishop at Playwrights Horizons. He created a safe space in which we could try new things. And early on, we had a mentor, and it was Alfred Urey, who, you know, wrote The Robber Bridegroom, which is having a wonderful revival right now. And he said, remember, your show is so unique. Throw out every single rule that you ever learned at BMI. He said, it has its own rules. It has its own logic. You don't need the comic song for the parents in slot number two. You know, you don't need the... And I think he was just saying, let the show be its own unique self. And that's great advice. And if you are lucky to find a producer who can encourage that, then that's gold. I think you get in trouble whenever, you know, the marketing is leading the show, you know. And of course, I'm not saying marketing is not important. It is. But, you know, I think the most important thing is the uniqueness of the show and allowing for that.
Of all your shows, which is the one that's changed the most during previews?
Oh, wow. I would say, I know the one that changed the most from the beginning of the writing till we got on the stage. That was The Glorious Ones, which is a show that took us 13 years to bring to an audience. And it was really hard, and I couldn't figure out why it was so difficult. And it was very Candide-like. It was very picaresque. It's based on a novel by Francine Prose, who's a wonderful writer. It's about the members of a commedia troupe. And the novel, each chapter is told from the point of view of a different character in the troupe. So we started it out. And there's so many incidents, so many characters. And we started out as quite a large-scaled show. And we did a first reading at Lincoln Center, I believe in 1993. And people say, how long did it take that show to be written? And I said, let me just put it this way. The ingenue was played by Donna Murphy in the first reading. That's all you need to know about that show. And it's also about changing of theatrical tastes and trends. And it's about these young Turks who come in this world of theater, and they basically steal the theater or morph it or change it from the more established artists. So there's an older artist and his lady friend, and a younger young Turk and his muse. And we started out writing that show, and I thought, I totally get this young Turk character. I understand it. And then it took us 13 years. So by the end of it, I go, I'm totally relating with the middle-aged character. I really get his story. And I think it was actually a blessing it took that long, because I was able to understand every aspect. But that changed the most. It started out as a large scale show. And by the time we reached Lincoln Center, it was seven characters playing all of these different parts in their style. And we were at the point where we were going to give it up, because we couldn't crack the nut of the show. We had some amazingly exciting and beautiful songs, but we didn't have a show that we could make work. And oddly, to her great credit, Francine Prose, the novelist, she said, I know you've been working all these years and you keep renewing the rights for this novel. And, you know, I've never heard any of the songs. So before you give it up and let it go, I'd like to hear some of the songs. And we thought, that's a fair request. So she and her husband came to Lynn's apartment, and we just started playing through a couple of the songs from The Glorious Ones. And she, after the first song, was in tears. Let me hear more. Let me hear more. And she was like, so effusive, so unbelievably supportive. She said these songs are like one act plays. This has to be in a theater. And we said, well, I said, no offense, but we can't find a way to lasso your plot. I said, the plot is driving us mad. And so she basically said, like, throw out what you want, use what you will. And she was amazingly generous, and that helped us crack the nut of The Glorious Ones.
Incredible. And now you're just a couple months away from your newest piece hitting a stage. Weeks?
I am starting rehearsal in 2 weeks from today.
So when you wrote the song for Anastasia for the movie, did you have any idea that you'd be a few weeks away from the regional?
No. It came out of the blue. We had been developing an animated film musical for Disney. And this will tell you something about timing, you know, because I don't want to go there, but anyhow.
I'll go there.
Okay. So we were working on an idea that I thought was a really cool idea. It was about the migration of whales, and it was about community. And as we all know, the whales communicate through song. So they literally do sing. They literally communicate that way. Larger than life. And I had been, for my own fun, believe it or not, listening to these amazing Roger Payne recordings of the whale singing. Elaborate tunes, like really amazing melodies. And I thought, oh, it could be about fathers and sons. It's literally about a journey. It's literally about a migration. And we started working on the piece. And it starts out with the whale singing, and then it becomes the sound of the human voice. And then bit by bit, they're singing lyrics. And we loved working on it. And of course, you can see this coming like a train. They were working on another animal musical at the same time Disney was. And so it was something that I don't think anyone's ever heard of It was called The Lion King. And so there was the whale show, the Lion King. And I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it. There is a wonderful scene in The Lion King that was from our whale project. You may remember it. It's like whenever he looks up and sees his father in the sky as a constellation. I found it even more moving when it was whales, but I just put it out there. I just put it out there with no judgment.
I try not to laugh in these podcasts, but I can't help.
I know. And then you think like The Lion King, and then you think you would have bypassed that. And then Ragtime comes out and we open this amazing show with the best cast day ever. And we were across the street from The Lion King, the stage musical. And it's like that crazy show is just like biting, you know, it's Pac-Man at my rear. So anyhow, we let go, but because of the people we met at Disney, we got a chance to work on a piece for 20th Century Fox, which would become Anastasia. And I love the world. I love the fact that there was a mysterious element to it. I found that amazing. And it was a really great experience for us. And these films take a long time. This took 4 years. And so we were actually writing Ragtime simultaneously to Anastasia. So in the time it took us to write 35 songs that reached the stage of Ragtime, we wrote 6 songs, I believe, that made it into the movie, which tells you that's like a little window into like the difference of process. But the experience, the world, all that was fantastic. And then all these years later, we were approached, is this something that you'd like to do for the stage? And I think we both loved the material so much, but I think if we were to go with it, we wanted to reconceive, you know, for the stage. We didn't want it to be, here's an animated film that we're going to put like frame by frame into, you know, into a theatrical telling. And also, as some of you may know, the film did play rather fast and loose with Russian history. You know, Rasputin did not rise from the grave. He was not accompanied by an albino bat and these colorful green minions that would break into song. That none of that happened, as far as I know. So we thought it would be interesting to go a little more back to what the story was. So I actually think the stage musical, even though we have five songs from the motion picture, it's really a new show, and it's inspired by the legend of Anastasia. And this is our third show with Terrence McNally. So that's been great. And I think Terrence was interested only if we could treat the show as if it were an original musical. So even though we have a song like Journey to the Past is in the show, it's used in an entirely different context than the film, and I actually think it's stronger. So you know, we're excited. We're 2 weeks and we roll up our sleeves and you know hear it sing. So it's wonderful,
incredible. So it opens in Hartford in just in weeks, and then hopefully yeah. Broadway later yeah. on this next season, perhaps.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So if you're in the Hartford area, we begin performances May 12th. We open officially the 27th, and then we're running into June. And we're excited. This is the first time we've worked with Darko Trezniak, who did Gentleman's Guide. And he's a wonderful director, and he's kind of the perfect director for this piece. And it's wonderful going back to that. You know, and I thought it could be difficult, you know, because that was a world that we were quite involved in 20 years ago, you know, musically. But I had done so much research that it must have been like in me, and it was actually very fluid writing, and we were right back, you know, into that world, and you know, I've been able to go deeper musically, which is exciting.
Oh, well, I'll definitely be there for that. Okay, last question. Mm. I call this my genie question.
Uh-oh.
I want you to imagine... Genies are good. Don't be scared. I want you to imagine...
Wait, is this about Aladdin?
Well, sort of. Okay. But it's right. Not about the Lion King. So okay. It's Disney,
well, that's
but
good.
The Lion
I feel like I'm in a safe space then. Okay,
Mustafa right. knocks on your door.
Yeah, that's
and says,
right.
No, the genie comes to you and says, Stephen, your contributions to the American Musical Theater have just been so incredible. I want to thank you for that.
Thank you,
and
genie.
I want to grant you one wish.
Ah.
Now, Stephen, you're such a positive person. You look at everything's fun, even when you're faced with challenges. But what makes you angry? What is the one thing about Broadway that keeps you up at night, that frustrates you so much, that makes you mad, that you would ask this genie to change with the rub of his lamp?
Yeah. I don't understand why there can only be one hit. And I use that, I'm putting quotes around that word, per season. You know, I don't understand that. There, I think the theater landscape used to be, there was a whole variety of different exciting work, you know, in any given season. And now it seems like either you're a hit or you tank, you know, and there's like, well, like whatever happened to any sense of middle ground, whatever happened to the numbers of 2 through 9, you know, and I don't understand that, you know, and I find a healthier atmosphere in the regional theater, and I find a healthier atmosphere in terms of not only for the working condition and for the creative aspect, but for the audiences too, in off Broadway. You know, I remember the season that it was like, I saw two shows. I saw a show on Friday and a show on Saturday. I saw Rent on Friday at New York Theater Workshop, and I saw Floyd Collins at Playwrights Horizons on Saturday. Amazing shows, totally having their own sense of self, totally the voice of their individual creators, and as different as anything. I'd like to think that the adventuresome work will continue, you know, and this season, it's actually been, there's been some really cool stuff, but I find that most of my exciting nights in the theater are not on Broadway, you know, and I wish, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just because the cost of making musicals is so great now. I mean, what's your theory? I don't know.
Yeah, because it's so expensive, it's getting harder and harder to take risks. But luckily, something bursts through like Hamilton and hopefully convinces all of us out there to go like, oh, maybe we should take, or Fun Home. We've seen some good stuff.
I mean, look at the public theater these past 2 years. I mean, it's like a prime example of creating a safe, creative space for artists to do their work. And frankly, it's, you know, musicals are slow cookers. You know, some happen very, very rapidly. Most, you know, have to be developed and nurtured over time, you know, and that Oscar and that institution, they've created that. And it's such exciting work, such a variety of work. And I remember seeing Hamilton downtown, and I thought, this is the kind of show that Joe Papp loved, because it respects the history of the art form and makes it new, and the cross-cultural aspect of it, and just the boldness and the freshness. And within those first 5 seconds, it has such a strong identity and sense of self, you know, and none of that is by chance, you know, and a lot of it is by producer. I mean, not to discredit Lin-Manuel and his talented collaborators, but for Oscar to create that environment for that to happen, it's special.
So. Well, thank you so much for being here and for being such an incredible positive spirit in the American Musical Theater. If you listeners are not excited about being involved in the theater after listening to Stephen talk today, I don't know what will get you there. Thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Thank you.
Look forward to Anastasia. Oh, and you know, I like to play One Degree of Separation between my current guest and my next guest.
Oh,
my
next
guest is Meredith Blair of the Booking Group, which I believe booked the tours of Ragtime and Seussical. So there's always a connection.
There always is. It's like 2 degrees of Ken Davenport.
I like that game. We'll play that next week. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next time.
Okay, everybody, this podcast is over, so now you know what to do. Go on to iTunes, give us a great rating. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.